session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 17.
Ted, I believe at the end of December 1940, you had an encounter with a Messerschmitt 110 while out on patrol.
This was at a distance and really of no significance other than having the opportunity to use the clouds to get away and remove myself from the scene. That's about all that happened. But it is an example of the way you had to be on the qui vive all the time when by enemy-held shores. And also, we weren't yet sure where defending German aircraft were coming from. We weren't yet specific about the airfields they were using, so it was just a matter of getting away as quickly as possible. There was no actually encounter, firing at each other, that kind of thing.
And I believe as well at that stage you were actually doing leaflet drops over Denmark.
Oh, yes.
Well.
Yes, that was very hilarious to the crew. The leaflets had some kind of message of hope for the Danish people, that the Americans were being helpful and might well come into the war fairly soon. We just had to fly across and drop these leaflets over Rinkeby, which is about halfway down the Danish coast. There's an entrance to what we would normally call a lake beyond sandbars, and very little human habitation. I think it was February or March, 41, and there didn't really seem much point in dropping them. We could only suppose that either they were short of toilet paper that they were short of lighting fuel for their stoves. But it turned out to be quite a funny incident, because there was a nice layer of cloud, 2,000 or 3,000 feet, which we could get into if we were troubled. But there wasn't any sign of any trouble, and we just sort of we were just laughing hilariously about the whole thing whilst Lewis, forgotten his name temporarily, my wireless operator, was dispensing these pamphlets out through one of the side windows, and they were just fluttering down onto a frozen lake, and the land was covered in snow. We saw no one other than a German soldier with a bicycle, and so Lewis said, well, can you get down a bit lower and I'll see if I can throw one so that it unopened so that he's the target. And so we did that, but unfortunately he missed the target. But he did get off his bicycle, and assuming the recognized firing position, kneeling on one knee, etc., and sighting up his rifle, apparently he fired with some success. And because when we examined the aircraft after we landed, there was a bullet hole on one of the the rear rudder surfaces. So we went back and said we'd done the job, but whether anyone had benefited remained very much in doubt. Anyway, it did show that we were optimistic, even if no one else was. But can you just imagine a Dane picking this up, having very few instances from which he could claim there was any sign that Great Britain was able to do anything to alleviate their situation. However, that's what happens from time to time, I suppose. Somebody perhaps in government decided that we ought to let the Danes know that we hadn't forgotten them. That's the way they decided to do it.
What kind of level height did you drop the leaflets at?
Sorry?
What kind of height did you drop the leaflets from?
Well, it varied, really. We had to experiment to see which altitude gave us the best distribution. I think probably between 500 feet and 1500, something like that. But of course, when we decided that the German soldier was the target, we went down to 50 feet or something of that sort. But certainly the soldier's aim was better than Lewis's had been.
And in about March, I think you moved up to Wick, didn't
you?
Yes, Thornaby.
And this was another detachment originally. What was happening was that Bomber Command had been persuaded to let Coastal have one or two Blenheim squadrons to take over the work we were doing, particularly in the lower reaches of the North Sea, so that we could, Coastal Command could spare more aircraft for the double jobs we had to do, going out west or going east, as the occasion demanded. Wick was quite different, of course, to Thornaby. Wick is, it can't be much further north in Scotland than it is, apart from Duncan's Behead and Thurso, which is on the north coast opposite the entrance to the Orkneys and the Scarpa Flow. One of the points about Wick, of course, was that it was an airfield from which Scarpa Flow, the naval base, expected to be protected. The beauty of Wick was that it gave more coherence to activities both in the mess and in the air, because there were very few outside distractions. It was quite a nice aerodrome to fly from. It had, I don't know when it had its runways, but they seemed to be quite well used before we went there. The purpose of our detachment was to help in the moving of 269 Squadron to Iceland, where following our landing and consolidation in Iceland. Eventually, of course, 269 Squadron as a whole moved to come to Darness, about 50 miles southeast of Reykjavik in Iceland, and in April, beginning of April 1941, the remainder of 220 Squadron moved up to Wick, so that the whole squadron was then based there.
What was the surrounding countryside like at Wick?
It's an area of obviously high cliffs, typical Scottish terrain, high cliffs, and instead of the high mountains, a very flat hinterland around Wick. And it's got a certain name. I can't think of it at the moment, but it's not all that many years ago that several well-known people started buying the land because it's of a certain unusual type. They were doing that in order to try to preserve it. I don't know what else it could be used for, but it does mean that it's there. It's going to stay as it is, one presumes, in perpetuity. And it's an area of it looks as though it's had a heavy fall, been under the ice. Let's say it's just come out of the ice age. It's sort of flat and scarred, pebbly, a few rocks here and there, very little, if any, soil as such, a lot of lichens and small organisms, if you like, both in small areas of water and on the land itself. So one would hardly call it hospitable. And that stretches out to the west, almost as far as Dunray, where they established the first of the nuclear, whether it was just research establishment or not, I don't know. And then thereafter, out to the west, over which we flew, of course, many times to depart from Cape Roth, the northwest corner of Scotland. It continues in its inhospitable way, which is quite different, incidentally, from the normal Scottish reception. We found they were very welcoming wherever we met them. But Cape Roth suggests that strand in the Scottish character to give it strength and determination and occasionally awkwardness. Cape Roth is quite a barren area in its grandeur. We were glad that we were above it and not on it.
What was the weather conditions like all around the Wick area?
Well, at that time of year, it's a very variable type of weather that you get in northern Britain. Incidentally, of course, many Scots people prefer to be known as North British, and I know of Scottish people who put Great Britain as their address, and then NB, North Britain. And it's very difficult to forecast, particularly, obviously, in wartime, where you've got very restricted weather forecasting facilities. It varied from cloud on the deck, because the airfield at Wick is some 100 feet, I forget exactly what, above sea level. And quite frequently we would have to take off and almost immediately go into cloud. And one should be prepared for that kind of thing. My own method was always to have a plan B. And it proved its worth on one occasion when we took off, followed shortly afterwards by another aircraft doing or intending to do a similar patrol. And it was a matter, I felt, of climbing up high enough to be above any high land, whilst on a northeasterly course, and then gradually turning towards the west, so that one would assume that one was over the sea, and flying for a predetermined length of time on the westerly course until being pretty sure if one decided to descend, you'd be clear of the land. And in fact, that's what happened, and we came out of cloud about 1,000 feet, well clear of Cape Roth. Unfortunately, the chap who took off more or less the same time decided he would try and get under the cloud and stay under it, and eventually he crashed into Hoy, just off the mainland of Orkney. We dreaded that this had happened on the way back, because there was constant wireless traffic asking him to call, and there was no reply. So we had been warned when we landed, and that this was probably what had happened. And of course, there's no sign of the aircraft or the remains at all.
Could high winds be a problem? Could high winds be a problem?
Oh, yes, yes. There's nothing to stop them, of course, up there. I remember one April day when the snow, well, it's not unusual even today, of course, when snow was quite thick at the beginning of April, and so it stopped flying because we couldn't really get off the runway because of the slush and so on. And in those days, on a lot of airfields, there was very little in the way of runway clearance of any snow or ice and so on. So, yes, high winds, they were quite consistent, as I remember. I mean, if you went off with a high wind blowing from the northwest, because that was an area where areas of low pressure were predominant, you could be pretty certain that it was going to continue to be a high wind coming from the northwest for some time, and that's always better than having a lot of wind changes, and when you come back from a 7-hour patrol to find that you probably, and particularly if you've had to fly for a time in cloud or poor visibility, you've probably been working on a wind which was given to you on departure, and by the time you got back it's changed quite a bit, which then gives you a glimmer of an idea as to why you didn't meet the convoy you were supposed to be escorting.
Given that the job that you was doing was a constant one of patrolling and different operations, what type of conditions would flying be cancelled under? What would they have to be?
Now that is a difficult question to answer. I think it would be true to say that there were pilots on the squadron with strengths in different aspects of flying, and whereas if the weather conditions were not helpful, let's leave it as broad as that, whatever had been planned as an operation or operations may have to be diluted, minimized, shall we say, according to the strengths of the personnel available to fly at that particular time. I can't remember any period when there were when there was more than one cancellation because of inclement weather. So I think it would be true to say that we got off in most types of weather, but possibly not for all the operations that were planned on that particular day. There might be one which was more important, and that would be attempted. But I don't think that that really concerned us, most of us anyway. Some people were better at one thing than another. But if you trusted your airmanship and your instruments, well, they never let me down anyway.
Was there a particular type of weather, though, you didn't enjoy flying through?
I think I'd rather put it the other way, and there were aspects of the weather which I enjoyed flying through very much. And then in a diminishing scale, I mean, obviously, at that time, it was just wonderful to be able to fly, to be allowed to fly with all this freedom. I mean, we were the boss of what we surveyed, unless we were given a multi-aircraft task, which didn't happen very often at that time in our way of work. And to fly across the North Sea on a beautifully sunlit day and a calm sea, and perhaps the radio giving us a nice tune or two, at least as an interlude on the way across, that is perfection. And then, of course, if you have sun cloud, then you've got to start thinking, what are you going to do with it, or how is it going to affect you? So we begin, I mean, we're starting off with a score of 10 for a perfect day. You're down to about an 8 by that time, just cloud that has to be thought about. And that would usually be to us, because we were low flying, relatively speaking. That would be perhaps cloud of 3,000 to 4,000 feet in height, and 8/10. In those days, we measured the amount of cloud in the sky in tenths. At some stage it was changed, but I can't remember when. But anyway, we're talking in tenths. And 8/10 cloud is okay. You're getting some sunshine through. You know that the cloud is not continuous going up to any great height. There's a lot of difference, of course, between a cumulonimbus cloud, which is normally looked on as a storm cloud with a bit of thunder, and a stratus cloud, which is the type of level cloud which reaches across the sky. So there are these variations, but when we're getting down to a grade of about 6, then the cloud is lower. At 2,000 feet, it means that if you do want to go up, you've got to be sure what you've got above you. You've got to know exactly where you are, because you don't know where you're going to come out. You get down, the cloud is down to 1,000 feet, then that's only a score of 3 or 4 out of 10. If it's on the deck, which of course it never is really on the sea, but it is as far as you're concerned, you can't get any lower to the deck than the bottom of the cloud. If it's about 50 feet, then it's 1 out of 10. And if it is any lower than that, as we later experienced whilst in Iceland, then it's a dud. It's 0 out of 10. So that's how weather affects you.
Was there a problem with sea mist at all, or is that something that's not a factor?
Oh, yes. There's a name for it, isn't there, in the North Sea, the Har or something of that kind. Yes, it varies again. I can't really think of any time in 1941, anyway. It did happen later when I was in quite different circumstances. But at that time, and in those northerly latitudes, there wasn't all that much sea mist, because if you think about it, sea mist is caused by heat and cool air coming into contact with each other for some reason, such as if the land, if you can think of it more of a summer's day to explain this, if you think of on a summer's day, if the wind is normally blowing from the west and you are on the east coast paddling away in the sea, by afternoon the wind may have completely swung around, and a sea mist will have started to creep in, because the land is warming up, or has warmed up during the morning, quicker than the sea. The sea, of course, is cooler than the land until very late in the year in these latitudes. So the cold air comes in, just drifting in from the sea over the land, until the sun loses its effective warmth, and then the wind reverts, under the circumstances I'm describing, to a westerly flow. So you can have had west wind in the morning, an east wind, well, it's not really a wind, it's just a drift as it comes in, and then back to the west wind in the evening.